This is Digital Dave of EAA Radio, and I'm joined today by Captain Kay Heyer, a naval aviator and also a NASA astronaut. How cool is that?
Wow, I'm very fortunate, and it's great to be here with you today.
Well, let's talk about how you got started as a naval aviator. It wasn't a career most women aspired to many years ago. I mean, I don't know how long you've been flying, but probably a couple weeks at least.
For a few years, actually, right out of high school, I went to the Naval Academy, and after the Naval Academy went to flight school and was able to fly P-3s in a squadron that's actually no longer there. It's been decommissioned, but I flew oceanographic research with the Navy Squadron VXN-8, and we flew oceanographic research missions worldwide. We flew for the Naval Oceanographic Office. We took scientists and engineers and all their equipment and basically flew to whatever part of the ocean, wherever in the world, that they needed to gather some data. And at this time, it was back in the 80s, in the early 80s. It was kind of Hunt for Red October time. And so our big focus at that time during the middle of the Cold War was anti-submarine warfare. And for anti-submarine warfare, one of the important things that we needed to know was the environment of the ocean, because one of the ways you detect where submarines are is use sound wave sonar. But sonar is quite affected by water temperature, density, and salinity, and even just ambient noise that could be there present in the water. So these are the kind of studies that we did. We also did magnetic studies and studies of ice edges and where the ice is thin and where possibly a submarine might be able to surface through the ice in the Arctic regions. So that research took us worldwide. Over 3 years of flying with the Navy, I flew P-3s 1,500 flight hours to 26 countries. It was quite an adventure. It was, and you know, I was living the slogan for the Navy at the time was "Join the Navy, see the world," and I certainly took advantage of that.
Saw through those little windows because they kept you flying more than they put you on the ground, it sounds like. What was your typical mission duration? I understand those planes can be out a long time.
They can. We would fly between 10 and 12 hours, and one of our airplanes, we actually took the bomb bay of the payload bay and sealed that up and put a sixth fuel tank in there. And that one, we get about 14 hours out of that one.
Okay, that's more than bathroom range.
It was more than one crew range. We would actually bring extra pilots on those. We would bring like four pilots and three naval flight officers and also all the supporting crew in the back.
Now, did you find that, I mean, fascinating? Or I guess as flying goes, you fly to a point, you fly around circles for 18, 12 hours while they're reading instrumentation, and you're like, okay, this is it.
Yes, I will admit there are portions of those long missions that could be incredibly boring, but also portions that could be incredibly exciting, especially flying in the Arctic areas and seeing the northern and the southern lights, flying over both the North and the South Poles, just all the incredible things that we saw in between. Just quite the adventure.
Sounds like a lot of fun. I'd love to go up on that airplane. That's one of my personal favorites. But that wasn't enough, apparently. You decided to go even further and faster and higher than any man had ever gone or something. Whatever the catchphrase from that movie was.
Well, again, I've just been so very fortunate. I flew in the Navy, as I mentioned, with VXN-8. After that tour, I was an instructor for naval flight officers, and I did that at Mather Air Force Base at the Naval Air Training Unit. That's all since closed down and moved away from there as well. But I was training the naval flight officers that were going to P-3s and C-130s. After that tour, I decided to leave the full-time active duty Navy and stayed with the Navy Reserve, but went to work for NASA as a contractor on the space shuttle, as a space shuttle engineer, and went and picked up my master's degree and kept applying to become an astronaut, and eventually they picked me up to be a NASA astronaut.
Now that's way cool. That is way cool. Now, you never considered yourself breaking barriers as a female naval aviator at the time?
Well, certainly the majority of my career, I've been either the only female around or one of very few. And, you know, I never really set out to be the first. You know, it was like I never said, oh, I'm going to be the first woman to do this or do that. It was more like these opportunities came along. And I was like, wow, that's great. As a kid, I always wanted to fly. When the opportunity became available, I was just so tickled to be able to do that. And even with becoming an astronaut, when I was a little kid, there were no female astronauts. I didn't set about to be a female astronaut. I just thought, man, flying in space is pretty cool. I'd really like to do that. And when the opportunity became available, I've just been so incredibly fortunate to be able to take advantage of it.
Now, it's not at all like Star Wars, though.
Not yet. You know, it's funny, though. We're halfway through 2011, and as a little kid, I sure thought by now we'd all have our own little jets and mobiles, and we'd all have our own personal spacecraft. So I'm a little disappointed we never got to that. But I will tell you, in the 30 years that we've just completed of flying the space shuttle program, it is something to see, you know, all these international partners and what the ingenuity of the people here in the United States, what we have built. You know, with this space shuttle and the space station that we constructed in space by using the space shuttle.
The largest man-made object in space.
It's incredible.
Yep, and you can see it naked eye. I have watched it fly over.
Absolutely.
And you were probably on there going, in fact, NASA sent me a letter. Never to go outside without a hat. Reflection off the bald spot was blinding the astronauts.
Yeah, there's some reflections sometimes that kind of make it back up to us, because we're only a couple hundred miles up. We're really not that far away when we're...
How long did you spend on the space station? You're never assigned to it. You were flying resupply mission.
Correct. Actually, I was fortunate enough. I had my first space shuttle mission was actually before the space station was built, and we conducted research in a space lab that we had in the payload bay of the space shuttle. That was on STS-90, and that was a great resource, you know, to be able to have this laboratory. But we were limited to the length of the space shuttle mission, which was only a couple of weeks. So over time, as we built the International Space Station, we now have this laboratory in this microgravity environment of space, which is such a unique environment to be able to study different things from protein crystals to material science to the effect on the human body. We're growing viruses up there to understand how they grow so that maybe we can intervene and stop that growth. There's a lot of research that's going on, and it can go on much longer term now because we have a crew up there of six people 24/7, and that's going to keep going. Space station has been guaranteed to be funded through 2020, and we hope longer.
I sure hope longer, because I don't want to see that thing come down.
Well, that would be quite impressive.
That would be a lot worse than Skylab, which was a shoestring program on itself. Anyway, but you worked for NASA as an engineer. What type of engineering did you do?
Well, I started as a space shuttle engineer working on the orbiter mechanical systems, the wheels, the tires, the brakes, the landing gear systems, the payload bay doors, the hatches, all the little vent doors, the deploy mechanism on the Ku-band antenna, basically any of the little motor-driven type systems and mechanical type systems, which was really a good background to have later on when I actually became an astronaut being able to fly.
You better be careful, because when they find out you know something, they want you to fix it.
Yeah, I did get to my last mission was last year, STS-130, and that mission was a space station construction mission. We took up Node 3 and the cupola, and not only did I get to install those, but I got to turn a bunch of wrenches and do a lot of electrical connectors and fluid mating connectors on board the International Space Station to put all that together. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I understand that was one of the major challenges of the whole space station program, was learning how to work tools in space.
We're still learning. Every day we learn something more. And even though we have very brilliant scientists and engineers, and they understand it's going to be used in the microgravity environment of space, there's still stuff they kind of forget. And then we kind of learn on orbit. And just like anywhere else, we adapt. And I was so fortunate that my Navy background, I think, set me up perfectly to be an astronaut, especially on the two missions that I had. My Navy experience of flying the researchers all over the world to gather the data and the information that they needed, translated to flying with NASA as an astronaut, where we become the eyes and the hands for the researchers here on the ground. We're conducting the experiments for these researchers that have spent, some of them, the better part of their lives getting their experiment flown.
And you have to, they've got to do more or less of a brain dump, try and make you into them so that you can interpret the experiment for them.
Right. Although sometimes there's really not enough time to interpret the data so much as just make sure we're operating it properly for them.
Getting real data, valid.
Getting the valid data, not contaminating the data. And if something's not going right, to somehow try to fix the equipment. We end up doing that a good bit too.
That's the ultimate in reliability. Space. It's always been a challenge.
It is always a challenge. You know, we built the International Space Station not mating these things and fit checking them on the ground. These components were built in all these different countries, and the first time they saw each other was on orbit in space.
That's a scary thought.
It is scary, because every time you're up there, and I know, you know, I installed Node 3 and the cupola, which were built in Italy, and flown to the Kennedy Space Center, put on board the Space Shuttle Endeavour. We flew it up to the space station. And, yeah, we were holding our breath quite a bit when we used the robotic arm and moved it over. And, I will tell you, it did not go perfectly. We did run into some issues, and we worked through them. And
somebody went outside with a file and just pulled up over there.
Yeah, you know, having to pull it in just a little further than what they told us we were supposed to be able to do on there. But we got all the latches latched, and the leak checks were good, and we were able to utilize the Node 3 and the cupola.
Okay, great. Did you put the vacancy sign on the front there so, you know, people can come up and rent rooms?
Not yet. No. I'll tell you what, though, with Node 3, what was going on and why Node 3 was so important was up until the time we installed Node 3, we had a lot of our life support type of equipment taking up a room in the U.S. laboratory. The air revitalization system, the water recovery system, the treadmill, the potty, a lot of just crew type systems were taking up all this room in the U.S. laboratory. So when we installed Node 3, and during the 10 days we were docked to the International Space Station, we moved all that equipment into Node 3, freed up a lot of room in the laboratory, so the next mission after ours and several since, we're able to bring up actual experiments and put them into the racks in the U.S. laboratory. So we now have a full up running national asset there in the U.S. laboratory with this long-term research that can go on in this unique microgravity environment of space.
That is what it was all about.
Absolutely.
Permanent presence in space, possible launching pad for moon missions. I think we're a bit away from that, but you never know.
Well, we're learning more every day about existing for longer duration in space, and we're looking forward. We're looking beyond low Earth orbit. We've proven with the space shuttle we know how to get to low Earth orbit. And it's time to focus our efforts beyond that. However, we are going to continue with all this research on the International Space Station.
How did you feel when the program ended? It was like giving up your favorite car.
Yeah, I tell you, the space shuttle program has just concluded. And it is. It's like giving up your favorite car. The difference is we didn't quite have the replacement car ready to go. Normally, you have that replacement before you get rid of the high-mileage car or aircraft, and we just have a little bit of gap in time before we get the next vehicle. But I'll tell everybody to stay tuned, because we've got some very smart people. We're going to figure this out. We've been through this type of thing before. We canceled the Apollo program when we actually had Saturn V's ready to go to the moon.
That's
and
correct.
We had crews that were scheduled to walk on the moon. Can you imagine being one of those astronauts who had a date to walk on the moon and told, oh, your program's canceled?
Yeah, never mind.
So that's pretty devastating. Change is hard. Change is always difficult to get through. But I will tell you, look at what we came out of Apollo with. We came out with the space shuttle with which we built the space station. So keep that in mind,
right?
And you'll know that we're going to come up with something really great. Stay tuned.
It'll be it'll be Apple and the iRocket or something.
Who knows? We're not sure yet. We're working on it. We have a lot of people working on it, and we're
Mars.
We're starting to hone in on that. And yeah, Mars is out there, and we've got a pretty unique way that we think we're going to get there. We're looking at a plasma rocket that was actually designed and built by a former astronaut.
Now, plasma as different from an ion engine, I'm assuming.
So, yeah.
And more impulse.
It's quite
technology
something.
Is getting something. You're going to sit back and say, "Wow, I can't believe how far we've gone since you left."
I know it's going to speed up pretty quickly here. So, like I said, stay tuned.
Okay, now as a NASA astronaut, what did you think of the Spaceship Two and Spaceship One programs?
I love it. Again, like I mentioned earlier, as a kid, I thought certainly by now we'd all have our own spacecraft. So when I say I love it, I love that commercial industry is getting into the space business. It's like, where have you guys been? Come on. It's time. So I encourage that, and all the more folks that join, I think it's better. And for more people to be able to have access to space, that's wonderful. As an agency, as NASA, we encourage that. And we hope that more people will become interested and get involved. And maybe that's where some of the great new technology is going to come, is from the commercial industry. So we're happy that's happening.
Very good. Well, thank you for joining us, Captain Kay Heyer.
Well, thanks so much. And it's just so wonderful that the theme this year at EAA is the Centennial of Naval Aviation. I'm very, very proud and very honored to have had the opportunity to serve in the Navy and continue to serve. And I'd also like to just give a big shout out to all those who have served, all the veterans and all the current folks serving in the Navy and the Marine Corps. Congratulations for 100 years of naval aviation.
Successful naval aviation. Thank you again. And this is Digital Dave, and you're listening to EAA Radio.